This hour of Kevin Miller in the Morning is brought to you by Tway Travel, your adventure travel specialists fighting for America.
Well, the White House not exactly ending the year on a high note. A new poll from the Washington Post, ABC News, puts the president at the worst public approval rating of his presidency.
At this point, my goal every single day is just to make sure that we're delivering something.
Fighting for Idaho.
Colorado's marijuana industry getting a seal of approval. The state now handing out more than 300 business licenses to marijuana retailers, growers, and testing facilities.
Fighting for you.
Even though we have problems in our country, this is the time of year to look at all the good things and all the blessings that we have.
Boise's Mr. Right, Kevin Miller in the Morning.
Hey, buddy, you keep up the good work. Stay fired up, and I think your show's even better now that you're married.
On 580 KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
580 KIDO, Kevin Miller in the Morning here. Thank you all for joining us. Phone numbers 580-5436, KevinKIDOAM.com. We're joined by Mike Baker. We've been stalking him for quite some time. Glad that he has finally joined us. You catch him on the Travel Channel show, America Declassified. You've seen him on Fox. You've seen him on CNN. We've talked about his former career, the CIA. So it's great to have you here, Mr. Baker.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Nice weather we're having.
Well, you know, Ray and I were talking. I'm sure you've been to exotic locales in your previous experience, so I'm sure this is just like being in Afghanistan or wherever you've been.
Now everyone's thinking, I think Kevin just compared Boise to Afghanistan. I'm just happy to be here. You know, I've spent most of my life traveling around overseas and to some odd places, and honestly, it's just every morning I get up, and we've only been here about a year now since we've moved out from the East Coast, and I'm just so happy to be here.
Right.
Yeah, there's something about Boise that you don't find in other places. I still spend a lot of time traveling, but every time we touch down at the airport, I look out the window and I just can't explain it. It really feels like home.
Now, before we get into what you're doing on television and everything else, what are you doing? You're a television host. You own your own company. You used to work for the CIA. Probably still do, but we don't say that. But
yeah, thanks for saying it though. Just now,
the perfect cover.
Just
there,
between you and me.
Yeah.
So it's you know what, I got out of the outfit. I was in there for about 17 years, and spent the whole time overseas. I started out in what we call counterinsurgency operations. So that's pretty much what it sounds like.
That's the hot thing right now.
Well, it has been for quite some time, yeah, and it was before. I mean, the agency's always been, the CIA has always, it started out of World War II, right? It was the old OSS, and it came out of World War II. And so it's always had its own paramilitary operations, and we've got a terrific group inside that organization. And so you've got the maritime and ground branch and air branch, and then there's the traditional CIA, which is the role that most people think of it as, which it really is the primary role, stealing secrets, knowing what those that are working against our interests are trying to do, getting their plans and intentions and their motivations. That's the critical part of the CIA. Whether you're talking about the target being North Korea or Iran, or whether you're talking about the target being Al-Qaeda or some other terrorist organization. And so I was there for 17 years, got out. My daughter was getting older, and I was never home. And that turns out not to be a good equation.
Sure.
And so I thought, you know what, I've got to stay home. She didn't care what I was doing, right?
Right.
It didn't matter to her as long as I was there. And so I thought to myself, I have no other skills. you have to know your limitations. And I started this business diligence with a very close friend of mine who came out of the British teams. He was an SBS, which is their version of the SEALs. And so we had worked together over the years, and we formed up a company. And the company basically does global intelligence and security around the world. And we've been very lucky ever since then. We started it. We didn't have a clue what we were doing. And we wrote a business plan, which was the world's worst business plan, and shredded it about a week after we got started because we realized how crappy it was. And then we've been very lucky in the people we met, and it's been building ever since. And then now the company kind of ticks along on its own, and it allows me to chase these other projects and interests.
Now, before we get to your show, and again, I've watched every episode, so hopefully I'll be able to keep up, but what was it like to like live in your neighborhood? People always say, you know, well, you got this radio guy, and, you know, you try and have your privacy, but, you know, here you are. What would your neighbors think when Oh, you know, there's Mike. He works for the CIA. It's not like working at the Postal Service.
Well, yeah, because we didn't get uniforms.
Right.
I would have loved to have a uniform. But it's, you know what, nobody knew. I mean, it's not as if you talk about it. My family didn't really have a clue. My parents did. You know, I signed up at a relatively young age. So my parents were aware. Nobody else knew what I was doing.
Yeah, but how tough is that to keep those secrets? Like at work, like I go home and whine to my wife if you have a trouble with a coworker. Hey, I'm sorry, but you know, Timmy in Afghanistan is mad. You can't talk about that.
Right, and that's a very good point. That's a really good point, and that causes a lot of trouble sometimes.
Yeah.
Because you have to compartmentalize, and you're right. You're traveling overseas. You're doing something high speed. And then maybe you touch back down here, and you've got a little time, you know, to decompress or whatever you're doing. And, yeah, it's difficult. And then you get together with your friends, you know, and they go out, and they start talking about, you know, the latest arbitrage or, you know, what the market's doing and whatever the job may be. And you think, well, I couldn't find any commonality there, right? And
right.
So you're right. That part of it gets a little bit odd. But I found that with the agency and with a lot of things in life, I'm not necessarily a big thinker, right? I don't ponder a lot of things.
Yeah, but you got to be smart to be in the CIA.
Well, yeah, I may have bucked that trend actually. You know, I was told not to veer down a rabbit hole, but I was told when I got through my last interview, and I had been recruited in. I didn't think I was actually heading in that direction, but on my last interview, I sat down with a legendary officer there at the agency. He'd been around. And had really made a name for himself through the Cold War, and so very intimidating character. But I knew at that point I was already basically in. I had been tipped off by somebody who was in the process, and they said, "Yeah, so that's pretty good intel, right?" And I hadn't even gotten in yet. And so I sat there and I was feeling pretty cocky. Anyway, so this great guy who ran our Soviet Europe division at the time. Flipped through my file, and he was looking down at his nose at me and over his glasses, and he was staring at me, and I was feeling pretty good about myself. And so he looks up after reading my file, and he says, "You know, you have the lowest GPA of anybody we've ever recruited into the operations group." And I couldn't think of anything to say. So I looked at him, I said, "Well, that makes me a winner." He says, "No, that makes you an idiot." And then he stood up and shook my hand and said, "Well, congratulations." So I don't know. They certainly didn't recruit me for my smarts. But I guess my point being is I think sometimes in operations in particular, you don't want to overthink things. And it's like a lot of other parts of life. People get very twisted around the axle over things. And sometimes I find that what the agency really taught me was that there's never really a lot of options. Right, there's never really a lot of choices when you got to get off the X, and so you know the big life decisions sometimes aren't as daunting or as difficult as they seem. If you just break it down and you think, you know, you really don't have that many, you know, ways to move on the old decision tree. So I think I did well at the agency in part because I was just willing to get on with it and then not to stand around and ponder what it all meant at the end of the day. I was just happy to get a task, a job, a mission, and go off and do it.
Mike Baker joining us from the Travel Channel, America Declassified here at 580 KIDO. Now, one more question. How real is the homeland in the 24?
Well, it's as real as it's television.
It's television. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? 24. I always enjoyed 24. But honest to God, you know, Jack Bauer is just nothing but a big old bullet magnet. Everything was happening to Jack Bauer, and you got to do that for purposes of entertainment. And it's just if you've got explosions and car chases and all sorts of other crap going on around you, you're probably not doing your job well.
Right.
Because your job is basically to get in and get out and stay off the radar screen, and so. But I'm a difficult person to sit next to for any show like that. And my wife, Emily, who's absolutely the world's greatest person and is from Idaho, which is why we ended up out here, she hates watching shows like that with me because I'll sit there and yeah. I won't necessarily criticize, but I'll kind of do that thing where I'm and then I'll just sit down and make these noises, right?
Right.
And she, after about 5 minutes, she just gets up and leaves. And so I haven't really seen a lot of movies or TV shows about the business, about the espionage world or about spying that really blew my skirt up. There was one, and in part, obviously it's self-serving, but I was associated with it from its creation out in the UK. It was called Spooks out in England, and it was on. It was called MI5 here in the States. It ran for about 8 seasons, and that was all about character development. It wasn't about the explosions. You know, they had some,
right.
But the British television sometimes tends to let you develop the characters more. So I found that really interesting.
Mike, as we move along here at 580KIDO, I remember watching you on TV when you were, as we like to call them, the Big Fox, there at the Avenue of the Americas on Fox and Friends, previewing your new show, America Declassified. For those of us that watch Fox on TV, what was that like being there with Gretchen and Steve and Brian and the crew, and all of a sudden you've watched these guys, you're one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're a really great bunch, by the way, I should say. Brian Kilmeade, all the characters, Bill Hemmer, John Scott, they're all just terrific. Greg Gutfeld from Red Eye, I've been doing Red Eye for 7, going on 8 years now. They're just a great bunch of people. And I know there's a lot of folks that would be on the other side of that political spectrum who would disagree, but, you know, they are just very decent people, and they're trying to deliver. It's tough nowadays to deliver news in a somewhat objective fashion because of the way that the markets divide everything. And but it's a great bunch. They have a heck of an operation. I mean, honestly, I think Fox is beating every other news outlet 2 to 3 times over in every time slot. So they've certainly got a winning formula. And they do try. I've been on countless, numerous segments where they've got somebody on the far side of the left, you know, sitting there during the segment to have a conversation or try to have a conversation.
Watch out for that Hemmer. He's really good.
Yeah, he's very good. He's very good. But there's some break. And like I said, the morning folks, great. And Andy Levy, Greg Gutfeld from Red Eye, Bill Schultz. Terrific people. It was really good. And I'll be honest with you, when I got started with that, we had just started my company. And they were very good at the very beginning, just saying, yeah, it's, you know, here's Mike. He's with Diligence, you know, a global intelligence company. And they'd throw it right out there. And that's the sort of marketing, you know, we could never have afforded at the very beginning. So right off the bat, when we were building this business, we had that ability to get the company name out there. And that was really critical. So I owe them a lot.
More coming up with Mike Baker next.
Todd Schnitt, weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 580 KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
With us, America Declassified, his show on the Travel Channel, and congratulations, you've been renewed for season 2.
Yeah, I know. We just thank you very much for mentioning that. We just found out yesterday the network picked us up for the second season. So we're right now in the process, or I should say the production company Indigo Films, which is handling the production for it, and they've got their folks sitting around thinking, okay, we've got 13 new episodes to put together. What are we going to do? And because you've got to come up with these great stories. And the whole idea of the show, they called me about this thing beginning of last year. Well, I got a call shortly after we'd moved out here to Idaho, and some folks from the network and from Indigo Films called and said, well, we've got this project, and what we want to do is basically take the viewers around the country to places that they may not be able to get access to because they're restricted or classified or whatever it is, and then gain access or take them to places that are somehow wrapped up in a conspiracy or a mystery. And I said, well, that, you know, sounds great. I love history. I love traveling. And, you know, and who doesn't love a good conspiracy? And so I said, as long as it doesn't involve space aliens, I'm good to go. And so we got started. And they were, you know, they were true to their word. They found a lot of great stories. This coming Sunday, it's Sundays at 10 p.m., 8 p.m. out here, Mountain Time, we're going to be looking at the Martin Luther King assassination. And there's still, to this day, there's still a lot of people who think it wasn't just James Earl Ray taking that shot from the second floor bathroom at the boarding house across the street from the Lorraine Motel down in Memphis. And they think the Memphis police, they think the mob, they think a number of things about who was involved and how that whole thing came together. So, you know, we look at stories like that, and we're not trying to solve the problem for anybody. We're just trying to either find a new witness or maybe do some new forensic testing. Just give the viewers something interesting to think about and let them make their own decisions.
Well, let's start with the first one, and this is I mean, how emotional was it for you? I mean, I've been to Dallas once, and I drove by Dealey Plaza, and it was eerie. It was spooky. You investigated the assassination of JFK. Mm-hmm. What did you take away from that? What was it like being up there and actually holding the weapon?
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. We got permission from the authorities. First time in 50 years that a rifle's been fired down at Dealey Plaza. And so we ran some tests on the idea of a second shooter. And there had been one of the more credible witnesses to something other than just Lee Harvey Oswald was a fellow named Lee Bowers, who then died under unusual circumstances after giving some very interesting testimony. But he had been working in a switching yard that at the time of the shooting, the assassination, he reported seeing something, a puff of smoke or a flash, somebody moving behind the picket fence. And so we set up some testing involving firing off a number of rounds as a limousine came by to just try to get a sense of the angle and the speed. And
speak about this so casually, by the way.
Well, yeah, I know. My concern was, as I pointed out to the production team, you know, I'm standing here with this rifle. I'm going to, you know, pop up over this picket fence and start firing off rounds. We're in Texas. There's a very good chance that a lot of these pedestrians are going to start returning fire. And they said, nah, we got the camera crews. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. And then, of course, they all backed away
right when
we started this. So, but it was, you know, the Dealey Plaza, if folks haven't been there, they really need to put that on their list because it's one of those places in America, and it's modern history, right? It's not so far removed. And you really do feel what impact that moment had, even if you weren't born, even if you were just very young. And so it's a fascinating place. And again, not trying to resolve everything. You know, we found a very interesting witness who had been working in the book depository, talked to her about sort of the timing of the whole event.
What was it like being up there in that window, though?
I'd tell you what the most striking part of it was the realization that it was not a difficult shot. Because you always hear about, well, there's no way he could have done this. There's no way. He was using an Italian bolt-action rifle with a scope on it. And frankly, his first shot was 175 feet away. And the target was moving very, very slowly, almost at a crawl, and in a straight line away. No wind, weather, lighting conditions that were problematic. And he had a chance to recon the site because Lee Harvey Oswald worked at the book depository. So he was there, and he had a chance to kind of recce his site, his hide, before he did this. And that's a tremendous advantage. So that was what I really took away from that, being up there and looking out from that same vantage point. So
emotional, though, was that?
It's really striking. I'm not, you know, I'd be lying if I said I remember what that moment in history.
Right.
I was born, but you know, but I do remember the knock-on impact that it had for several years after that, and that was a terrible time in our history. You think about that, Bobby Kennedy, you know, after that, Martin Luther King. There was a lot going on there that was really tearing this country up. But like always, we come through it. You know, we're very resilient. I knew I could come up with a big word during this morning. Resilient.
Mike Baker with us as we continue on here at 580 KIDO. Now, you also investigated possibly what happened to John Wayne. You were tasered. You were at the Stone thing. So we'll talk about that. And it's interesting when we come back, your take on the Taser headquarters, and you compare it to MI5 here. See, since I watched these episodes last night, I know what you've said.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going, who's this idiot savant over here?
You pay more attention to me than my family does. I appreciate that very much. This is Niall. Hang out here more often.
All right. More coming up next at 580 KIDO.
Dave Ramsey, weekdays noon till 3 on 580 KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
Kevin Miller in the morning. Thank you all for joining us. Phone number is 580-5436, 580-KIDO. Mike Baker joining us once again from the Travel Channel's America Declassified. So thank you for reminding this again in my cyber stalking of you. I forgot one of your more physically exerting episodes, which is escaping from Alcatraz.
Yeah, that was just a couple of weeks ago. I think it's still up on the Travel Channel site. What they wanted to do was back in 62. Three guys, Frank Morris and then the Anglin brothers. I just love saying that because it sounds like they're about to commit some sort of caper. They were hardened criminals. They'd been in and out of prisons, broken out of a number of prisons, and so they ended up on the Rock together. And Frank Morris reportedly had a genius IQ. Anyway, they spent about a year working on a plan to get off the rock. And it was an enormously creative and labor-intensive effort that they went through all this time. And it was incredible that they were able to accomplish that part of it. They got over the fence, down to the water, inflated their homemade life raft made out of prison raincoats, took their wooden homemade pallets oars made out of pallets, and set off in the water, heading for, they think, Angel Island, and were never seen or heard from again. So what we wanted to do was just, you know, try to feel what that was like. So we spent a couple of nights there at Alcatraz, and that is a fantastic place. Again, another one of those places to go to if you haven't been. An amazing, amazing history. And we were there late into the night. And then at one point we set off. I had two professional swimmers just to represent the Anglin brothers. We climbed on board a homemade raft made out of raincoat material and set off for Angel Island with, you know, some homemade paddles. And I tell you what we learned. A, we learned that water's really, really cold. It's very cold. And we had the advantage of wearing wetsuits. And then the other part is you just can't beat that current. If you're not in there at the right time and you start fighting that, you're just not going to win. And so we were in there for hours. And at a certain point, we've just finally had to put our hands up and say, that's it. It's just not going to happen. So we got close to Angel Island with the help of a speedboat.
Right.
You know, and then went in and swam the rest of the way just trying to see what that was like pushing this raft just to see in case they got close, you know. And after you've been in that water for a few hours, you know, you don't have a lot of gas left in the tank. But it was a fantastic experience. And probably one of the most interesting things about that was we had a chance to talk to a guy named Patrick Mahoney. Patrick was one of the guards there. He was there for several years. Mm-hmm. And he was there the night of the escape. And talking to him, you know, sitting in Frank Morris's cell, talking to a guard that was there that night and was there for several years, was just fascinating. Just a little bit of history that you know, has made working on this show really special.
Well, most of us have seen Escape from Alcatraz, but this was the actual real-life story of what happened. How big was the cell? And if you could describe how they drilled out and going up the inner workings for those that missed the show.
Yeah, incredible. Cells are very, very small. There was nothing about prison, particularly a hardcore prison like Alcatraz back then, that was about rehabilitation. You know, it was just, hey, look, you know, that's it. You know, there was no effort there to say, we're bringing you in here, you know, so that you can get your GED and lift weights and, you know, go out to society. So these cells were not in any way, you know, attractive. Not that today's prison cells are, but they're very small. And what happened was, you know, I believe it was Frank Morris discovered that because of the weather conditions at Alcatraz and because of the age of the prison, some of that the cement was crumbling. And so he started digging. Using various whatever he could find in the prison workshops, because they all had to work every day in various tasks, he started digging. And he was able to dig through a vent. And he found out from a couple of the prisoners who had been there for a long time that worked as plumbers that behind the cells, in between rows of cells, there was a 3-foot crawl space where a lot of the plumbing was. And so he managed to dig his way through the vent to get a hole big enough to crawl back into this crawl space behind his cell. But now there's rebar there, too, so he had to cut through the rebar. So he had to come up with ways to do that. And one of the ways they did this, to show how ingenious they were, they tried a lot of different things over the many, many, many months, was they would take dental floss from the dental shop, they would put compound cement on it from the shoe shop, and then cover it with silica from the dental shop and let it dry. And then they would basically have a bandsaw, and they would go at late at night after the lights out, they would get back to work. Night after night after night, month after month, they'd work on, you know, cutting through the rebar, digging out this hole. Then once they were back there in the crawl space, they went up 3 stories up to the top of the cell block.
This is while they're in prison.
This is while they're in prison. And this was incredible that it was able to go on. And talking to Patrick Mahoney, again, one of the guards that was there, he said, we were just stunned. We were stunned that they were able to accomplish this. And as he pointed out, most of the prisoners were aware of it because they were covering for these guys. They all wanted to see somebody get off the rock. And so they had the assistance of the other prisoners. And some of the prisoners, Whitey Bulger was there at the time. Whitey Bulger, I mean, crying out loud. We did a story on Whitey Bulger,
yes,
on America Declassified, you know, picking him up just a couple of years
Howie
ago.
Howie Carr's favorite guy, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So very interesting stuff.
Mike Baker with us as we continue on. Now, I forgot to ask you, A, what do you think happened during the JFK assassination? And B, what happened to these guys in Alcatraz based on your real-life first-hand experience there?
Well, with JFK, I do believe Oswald pulled the trigger. But I also think there was something else there. I think there was something beyond that. And the place that I tend to go, not a second shooter, but I think that there was other elements at play here, and probably from Cuba. Castro had the motivation. And he also knew a great deal about Lee Harvey Oswald. We have to remember, Harvey Oswald had skipped off to Russia, had denounced his U.S. citizenship, was a hardcore communist, wanted to be part of the revolution, was very disillusioned after he'd been in Russia, you know, during the Cold War for a couple of years, as you would expect.
Right.
He wasn't smart enough to understand what that all meant. And then he came back, but he was desperate then to help the Cuban Revolution. And so he had taken a trip down to Mexico and trying to get his way into and the Cuban Intel Service had a file, you know, a mile high on Harvey Oswald. So I think that there was something else at work there. But I do believe he took the shots. With Alcatraz, I honestly don't see those guys making it. There was a sighting several weeks after of a body floating out to sea, wearing apparently, you know, clothes that would match prison garb. But it was a different time, right? They didn't have instantaneous, you know, responses, and so you know this ship came back after, you know, crossing the Atlantic and the Pacific, came back and said, look, we saw a body out there. We made note of it in our log. They found a handful of personal effects floating in the water. No matter what your will is, and they had tremendous will to get off that rock, but no matter what your will is to survive, at a certain point, Mother Nature is just going to beat you down.
I think Jim Garrison was on to anything with his trial down there in New Orleans in the day, what they made the movie JFK on, or you think that was more Oliver Stone?
That was more Oliver Stone, yeah. I mean, I understand why conspiracies exist, obviously.
I mean,
we all want something bigger. Nobody wants to think that it was one guy with a rifle, you know, back then that could impact the nation so horribly. And so you want to believe there's something bigger there. And some conspiracies, you know, much around the, like the JFK, they stick around because there's some parts of it that can't be explained, or there's some parts that are compelling. Other conspiracies, you know, under the weight of some scrutiny, they fall apart.
Well, let's talk about John Wayne and his death. You were out there amongst the radiation. You lived through it.
Yeah. This is starting to sound more and more like a great series to be on, isn't it? Yeah. We're going to dump you in the middle of Ground Zero. We're going to taser you in the butt. You know, this is going to be terrific, Mike. You just stand by. The John Wayne story, I had no idea until they explained to me what it was all about. I had never heard this before. But back in the 50s, John Wayne made a movie, probably one of the worst movies ever made. Certainly the worst that John Wayne ever made, called The Conqueror, in which he's portraying Genghis Khan.
Yeah.
So he's a Mongolian warrior. Well, John Wayne, he's John Wayne, so he couldn't be bothered to do a Mongolian accent, right? So it's literally John Wayne in a Fu Manchu dressed as a Mongolian warrior talking like John Wayne. If you haven't seen this movie, you've got to fix yourself a drink, sit down and watch it, because it's fantastic. Anyway, he made this movie not too far away from St. George down in Utah. And it's about 100 miles, in the wind path of Ground Zero. And back then, just the year before they filmed this movie, they fired off 11 above-ground nuclear tests, one a month, basically. Several were much larger than what they did in Hiroshima. And so the idea was, look, you know, what prompted this story and what's prompted the stories ever since is that over half of the cast and crew of this production of The Conqueror eventually died of various forms of cancer. And you get out to this area where they did the filming, and they were out there for months. And they chose it to represent Mongolia because it's, you know, it's very alien-looking, and it's covered in dust. So you can imagine all this radiation, these particles floating from all these test shots, settling into this canyon. And we did some wind tests, and we saw, look, this stuff just lands here. It's in that dust. That dust is everywhere. They're breathing it in. It's covering their food and water. It's all over the place. They can't get away from it. So for a couple of months, they're out there inhaling all of this. And the idea being is, you know, let's take a look at it. Let's talk to some folks. Let's do a few scientific tests and see, you know, if we can get a little bit closer to making a determination. Is that what did it?
And you were outside a restricted area because the sheriff came.
Yeah, we went down to the town of Mercury, which was a very active town back during the Cold War and Ground Zero days. You know, we tried to get as close as we could. And the local enforcement authorities had another idea, so we had to pull up short. But still, again, one of those things where, you know, we wanted to take the viewers someplace that they're probably not, you know, able to see on their own or hadn't thought about going to see, and then tie it into something that's in that area. And St. George's is the nearby town there in Utah has always had a problem. You know, they call them the downwinders because they've had such a high cancer rate down in that town over all these years because, again, of these test shots that were going off. And that nuclear testing was very important. I mean, I would argue. I mean, sure. Again, it's very important stuff. But was the government, you know, disingenuous perhaps about the potential danger, or did they just not know? It was, again, fascinating story. And the whole idea of this thing, going into season two, we're going to be looking for a lot more stories like that where, again, let's take the viewer someplace. And we may be going over season two. We're not sure.
Does everybody at your house know that yet?
Well, I'm using this as an opportunity to tell my wife that we may be doing some of these shows overseas. Yeah.
Mike will be home soon. More coming up with Mike Baker, Kevin Miller, 580 KIDO.
Weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 580 KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
Kevin Miller, 580 KIDO. Quickly to Mark in Boise, you've got a suggestion for America Declassified, Mark?
Yes, Mr. Baker. I got a question. Since people like Jesse Ventura and his conspiracy True TV network, when he used to be on, and the History Channel, Travel Channel, have done things about the HAARP project, the U.S. Air Force's control, and weather modification, and chemtrails, do you plan on doing anything about the chemtrails and the government manipulation of our weather?
I think that would be a very good story, but I'd be lying if I said I had that sort of authority. You know, I'm sort of the trained monkey on the show. And so in terms of choosing the stories, normally what they'll do is they have a team of researchers and writers. They'll come up with a list, and then they'll throw them at me, and they'll say, you know, what do you think? And I've got a chance to maybe shape them a little bit, but there's people higher up the food chain on this production that make the call. But I will tell you this: I'll pass that one along and tell them they should consider it.
I have one more question. Are you aware or have heard about the high levels of radiation that are being reported that the EPA, along with the government of Canada, are not reporting? Basically, radiation plumes coming from the Fukushima power plant that are drifting over this country. I've got a son who found this on his website or internet. This was reported also on a TV news network. And sure enough, you go Google this, you find out they just had recently this past week high levels of radiation over Hawaii that basically drifted with trade winds over the United States, and they're especially high on the East Coast because it's already pretty much come across the U.S. And the reason why I brought this up is because of what you had talked about doing the story with the John Wayne crew down there in the Utah desert, and why the government would not want to at least warn us of this.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a really interesting question. A, I'd never trusted the Canadians. I'm kidding. I love Canada, but the fallout from talking about the Japanese nuclear disaster there, that you're right, and it is something that hasn't been covered particularly well in the Western press. You know, the Japanese press, they're on it constantly, and it's a continuing problem for them. But it's another good potential story, and these are the sort of things, and they do go out. You know, the guys that are working on America Declassified, the researchers and the analysts, they go out and they try to find stories just like this, and then look to see if there's something there that they can turn into a 20 or 25 minute story.
What's it like to get tased?
it locks you up. We did a segment story for one of the episodes on less than lethal weapons, and at the risk of turning it into an episode of Jackass where they're just, you know, constantly throwing crap at me to see what happens, we decided we went down to the Taser headquarters, and the guys that started Taser, back in the day. Terrific bunch, you know, and it's a great story. It's one of those great stories about entrepreneurship in America and, you know, just kind of bootstrapping it, starting out with not much money and having an idea and believing in it and building a business. And thank God, we're you know, the country is still, you know, the sort of place where you can do that, although I do worry that sometimes we're drifting away from that. But Taser's a great story, and as a less than lethal weapon, to give officers out there some other option so that they don't have to go to guns straight away. It's a very clean, very dynamic, very effective tool, but it does, I don't know any other way to put it, it locks you up.
Quickly, we've only got 20 seconds. Sure. What was their headquarters like, the Batcave?
Yeah, very very high tech. And you know, they did it on purpose in part because they've got a lot of research and development that goes on there. So the security is very tight, a very modern-looking facility. And as I mentioned on the story, I think, the last time I saw sort of an entrance that looked like that, it was the entrance to MI6 headquarters in London. Or MI5 headquarters in London, where you've got a very similar sort of entranceway. Fascinating stuff. Taser's a very interesting. I'm not getting any marketing fee for this.
No.
But it was an interesting episode.
Mike Baker, thank you, sir.
No, thank you very much. I sure appreciate it.
Valley's place to talk in the morning with Kevin Miller, 580 KIDO Napa. It's 8 o'clock.
Fox News Radio, I'm Dave Anthony. People are going shopping with gift cards today. There were a lot of them under Christmas trees this year. The National Retail Federation expects about $30 billion worth were sold, but some people are still waiting for gifts that didn't get delivered. Fox News Radio's Evan Brown has more live.
Now, Dave, thousands are still waiting on Santa surrogates to bring them or their loved ones their Christmas due. Barry and Amanda Batson from Atlanta ordered tablets for their kids last week, and UPS was supposed to deliver by Christmas Eve.
Set the kids down and told them that even if it didn't come, they'd be here shortly.
That was the main gift, so when it wasn't here, It was more hurtful for the parents than it was for the children.
Now, both UPS and FedEx blamed the spate of bad weather and an ordering surge the week before Christmas for overwhelming their infrastructure, Dave.
Evan, tens of thousands of Americans spend Christmas in the dark and are still waiting for power. An ice storm knocked out over the weekend.
Normally we have hot chocolate and our new Christmas pajamas, watching movies before bed in front of the lit Christmas tree. And that didn't happen.
She's in Lansing, Michigan. New snow today could make it tougher for utility crews in Maine. A plea for help from an American hostage in Pakistan. Fox News Radio's Jared Halpern has it live in Washington.
Wearing a gray tracksuit and sporting a long gray beard, 72-year-old Warren Weinstein is making a personal plea to President Obama.
I am asking you to please make the time and make the effort to take up my case and to negotiate my release and reunite me with my family.
Weinstein, an American development worker, was kidnapped at gunpoint from his Pakistan home more than 2 years ago. Al-Qaeda claiming responsibility. The White House reiterates it will not negotiate with Al-Qaeda. Dave.
Jared, Pope Francis is worried about the persecution of Christians, urging people to speak out against that the day after bombing attacks in Iraq targeting Christians on Christmas, killed 37. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
If you're a homeowner who's faithfully made your mortgage payments, you deserve thanks for doing the right thing. And I'd like to tell you about a powerful financial tool that rewards your commitment. Hi, I'm Jay Farner, president of Quicken Loans. And the tool that I'm talking about is the Home Affordable Refinance Program, or HARP. HARP is designed to help you lower your mortgage payments. It's for homeowners who are current on their mortgage payments, but due to the housing market, may have little or no equity left in their home. And even if you were unable to get a HARP loan in the past, new guidelines mean that now you may be eligible. More than 2.5 million homeowners have already taken advantage of HARP, and are saving an average of $250 a month. If you're one of the millions yet to take advantage, call us today at 800-QUICKEN. To learn more, call Quicken Loans today at 800-QUICKEN or go to quickenloans.com. That number again is 800-QUICKEN.
Important terms and conditions apply. Call us for cost information. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.
Stocks just keep going up. More gains on top of records this morning. Fox Business Network's Diane Macedo is here live.
That's right, Dave. The Dow is currently up 67 points after the latest jobless claims report showed 338,000 people filed for first-time benefits last week, hitting the lowest level in nearly a month. Meanwhile, a source tells Reuters the hackers behind a massive data breach at Target also stole encrypted personal identification numbers, raising questions about their ability to withdraw money from people's bank accounts. A Target spokeswoman says some encrypted data was stolen, but there's no evidence that PIN data was actually compromised. Dave?
Diane, the price of oil is up a quarter, now well over $99 a barrel. Gas is up slightly today. AAA's national average for regular is at $3.27 a gallon. A new study is critical of a knee surgery that's very common in the U.S.
If you're one of about 700,000 people every year who have surgery to repair a torn meniscus cartilage in your knee, new research shows the surgery didn't help many patients any more than physical therapy and, in some cases, doing nothing. That's the conclusion of a new study done by researchers in Finland. The operations are the most common orthopedic procedure done in the U.S. 80% of the tears are caused by wear and aging, and some researchers believe surgery in those cases should be limited. Steve Knight, Fox News Radio.
Christmas was violent around Newark, New Jersey. A 13-year-old girl and a 14-year-old boy shot to death last night. Another teen's in critical condition. That's not far from where three men were murdered at a strip club early on Christmas. Here's a good way to get arrested. A man in Phoenix, Arizona, went to the airport on Christmas, and police say he climbed a fence and ran onto a runway toward a plane that had just landed and started pounding on one of the Southwest jet's engines. Lucky for him, the pilot had just turned off the engines. He was charged with entering a restricted area, and you may not be shocked to learn he appeared to be impaired by drugs and alcohol. I'm Dave Anthony, Fox News Radio.
Fighting for America.
Well, the White House not exactly ending the year on a high note. A new poll from the Washington Post, ABC News, puts the president at the worst public approval rating of his presidency.
At this point, my goal every single day is just to make sure that we're delivering something.
Fighting for Idaho.
Colorado's marijuana industry getting a seal of approval. The state now handing out more than 300 business licenses to marijuana retailers, growers, and testing facilities.
Fighting for you.
Even though we have problems in our country, this is the time of year to look at all the good things and all the blessings that we have.
Boise's Mr. Right, Kevin Miller in the morning.
Hey, buddy, you keep up the good work. Stay fired up, and I think your show's even better now that you're married.
On 580 KIDO, Idaho's place to talk.
And good morning, Kevin Miller in the morning here at 580 KIDO. Thank you all for joining us. We do appreciate it. Don't forget to check out our blog concerning the health insurance debate debacle, and that will that is at 580kido.com. 1,730 people, millions of dollars spent, and ouch, that's where we are. Another big issue that we are talking about and has been a huge topic of conversation is the Common Core, the Idaho Core Standards, and I always want to make sure that we get every side of the issue. Our friends at Channel 7 had a recent story where they were talking about educators liking the core standards. Joining us in studio, Stacy Knutson and Stephanie Zimmerman, along with our friend Michael Brickman. They're our friends as well. We want to make sure we're fair and balanced on the friendly front. Michael Brickman on the phone to debate this issue. And Michael, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to have you with us. You're on with Stacy and Stephanie, and good morning to you, ladies.
Good morning.
And we start, Michael, you won the coin flip, so we'll start with you on your thoughts on the core standards. You are conservative. You believe that they're good, and they're good for the state of Idaho. Why?
Absolutely. I think they're a conservative reform that should be supported in states, especially like Idaho, where the standards that were in place before, frankly, weren't near as good. You can talk about whether or not every single thing in the Common Core is something that should be part of Idaho, but Idaho has the ability to up the standards, to add things to the standards if they'd like. And so if there are things that maybe got lost in translation, the transition between the old standards and the new ones, they can add to them.
All right, ladies.
Well, that sounds nice, but in reality, Idaho can add 15% across the board in all of Idaho, 15%. And if that, and with that 15%, it will not be included in the assessments. And these assessments are tied to teacher performance and school rankings. And so how long will things that are not tied to those, the evaluation system, be included? In fact, last year was the last year that Idaho is testing for the accelerated math track, because Common Core does not support kids going through calculus. And because we won't be evaluated on that and we don't have the funds, we've stopped testing to put kids on the accelerated math track. So it sounds nice that this can just be the floor and we can grow from there and we can add to it, but that's not the reality.
So if I could just correct one thing that you just said, one inaccuracy there is that kids can't accelerate beyond the minimum expectation of Common Core. That's simply not true. The Common Core, like any set of standards, is a floor. It's not a ceiling. Unfortunately, Idaho's floor was much lower than the Common Core's floor. So certainly you could accelerate in the old standards. Certainly you can accelerate in the new standards. But the old standards were missing so much that it was a problem, and most kids were missing key parts of what they should be learning.
So the fact that we've quit testing kids to go on the accelerated track, that's a reality of what's happening here in Idaho, has nothing to do with the fact that we can't add more than 15%, and we have chosen maybe at this time that the 15% might not include calculus.
Well, kids can definitely be taking calculus. There's no question about that. Calculus will not be going away in Idaho. Kids are welcome to take that. Kids are welcome to accelerate as quickly as they possibly can in Idaho and every other state. That's a decision that teachers, parents, and local school officials have been making in the past, will be making in the future. Absolutely nothing has changed there. And with regard to the 15%, certainly there might be a couple of things in the Idaho standards that didn't make it into the Common Core. Maybe you know of a couple of examples. And maybe you know of reasons why it's necessary to go above and beyond the 15%. Now, there's no Common Core police. There's no one that's actually really enforcing this. So, if Idaho wanted to go a little bit beyond the 15%, I don't think anyone's going to stop them. But I guess maybe a question for you is, why is it necessary for Idaho to add more than 15% to the standards? What are some of the examples of things that absolutely need to be added and would exceed the 15% in your mind?
I'd like to go back to the comment you just made about there being no Common Core police. Maybe not by name, but the Smarter Balance Assessment Consortium is the enforcement arm for Common Core. And how we perform on those tests determines our teacher evaluations, our school rankings. So that is definitely an enforcement arm. And that's why they're cutting out things like calculus, because they have to spend so much time teaching to these tests, to the Smarter Balance Assessment Consortium tests, which Idaho is one out of 25 states. We can't change those. So to say we don't have police, is a little inaccurate or flippant in a way, because we definitely have an enforcement arm in this. And
what I said, just to be clear, is that if you exceed 15%, no one is going to stop you, I don't believe. I think that's pretty accurate. And with regard to calculus, again, no one is stopping anyone from taking calculus.
Except that they're no longer testing to put kids on that track.
I'm not sure if you know how many students. Again, you mentioned calculus in the past has always been an accelerated track, which means not every kid takes calculus. The state test measures the state standards. The state standards, as I mentioned, are a floor. And so you want to make sure that everyone is at least meeting this minimum threshold. If people want to go above and beyond that, just like they did before, that's great. But if your concern is students aren't learning enough material, they're not learning enough accelerated hard material, why wouldn't you want everyone at least learning a minimum set of standards? And wouldn't you prefer the standard to be higher than lower? I guess maybe you can answer that.
Yes, and I'm glad you said that, because the Common Core standards by your very own institute are not the highest ranked standards. So if we're going to spend a lot of money revamping everything in Idaho, which I'm all for, who doesn't want higher standards? Then let's choose a well-tested, documented set of standards that are the very highest, because right now we have access to standards that are higher than Common Core, that your institute ranked higher than Common Core. And we could use those in Idaho at no cost. And there would be no 15%. There would be nothing. Just think how amazing Idaho could be if we took this standards and grew from there, instead of taking this mediocre set of standards that has been fed to us by this federal mandate with Common Core.
Well, a couple things. First of all, federal mandate, that's just flat out false. Secondly, Common Core is not a mediocre set of standards at all. Idaho.
Was it the highest set of standards that Fordham Institute ranked?
No, there were a couple of states that were a little bit higher, but to say...
A little bit higher?
So let me finish my thought if I could. So for you to say it's impossible for us to get where we need to be with the Common Core, you could add to it. The Common Core in our evaluation got a B+ in English Language Arts. It got an A- in math. Whereas Idaho's old standards got a C in English Language Arts. It got a B in math. So clearly the Common Core is higher. Now you might be able to get to a full A, but I don't know. Is there anything you can point to say that the 15% would be insufficient? I still haven't heard a single example of a standard you would like to add. So it's hard for me to believe that the 15% would be insufficient to get to a full A when, maybe you have some examples?
I can tell you what I don't like about the Common Core standards.
Well, what would you add to it? I mean, you see...
I would add a much stronger emphasis on classical literature. I would go back to standard algorithms in math in the younger grades, which is actually what your institute recommended in 2005 when they analyzed all the standards and
absolutely.
The importance
and the
of standards.
Strong focus. Excuse me. So the
no, it does not have a strong focus on the standard algorithms.
It moves them back a full 2 years.
Okay, let's let everybody have their chance here.
Some of these things that are being said, I'm certainly in agreement with everyone who's spoken that we want the highest standards possible. But to say things like kids are being moved back 2 years, to say things like there's not a very strong emphasis on the standard algorithms in the Common Core, these are things that are just simply not true, and I think it's unfortunate because it's misinforming the listeners who, if they just went and read the standards, they would see that there's a strong emphasis on the standard algorithms, so the basic way that you do math. Whereas in Idaho's old standards, you didn't even have to instantly recall your basic math facts. There is a very strong emphasis on literature. There's a greater emphasis on reading overall in all subjects because, let's face it, there are a lot of kids who are not reading on grade level by the time they graduate from third grade, which is a key year, and by the time they graduate from high school, so they don't have the skills they need to be successful later on.
Let's be clear that we are not advocating to go back to the set of standards that Idaho had before. We are advocating to get the highest set of standards possible in Idaho. And if we are going to revamp our system to make sure it's the very best and to have some evidence and some testing to prove it. So we're saying let's use the very best standards in the nation and then work with the highest performing countries to get the very best standards in the world and not take a set of mediocre standards that by your own institute, there's already better standards in the United States that we can get for free, and we don't have to revamp everything. We just have to step up what our teachers are doing. We don't have to have a dramatic shift in the way things are taught. So on the standard algorithm, it's just incorrect. You can, I would suggest that the audience go to the state of Idaho's website.
That would be at 580KIDO.
Yeah, and so the state of Idaho's website, and look at how they're suggesting that math be taught. It's not the standard algorithm. It's very different, which is why kids are struggling and why test scores are going down. Isn't because they're saying, we now want you to learn math, or we want you to learn addition and subtraction, and the kids are stumbling adding on subtraction. It's because there's a dramatic shift. And that word, I keep using the word dramatic shift. It's because that's the word that the authors of the Common Core Standards used. We want a dramatic shift. So it isn't just that we're asking your kids to shift, to step up. We're asking them to a dramatic shift in the way they learn.
So I guess I'm just a little bit puzzled then, I have to admit. You're saying on the one hand that, and I'm glad you're saying, that Idaho's old standards were not good enough. You're saying that Common Core is better than Idaho.
No, I'm saying that
okay,
Common Core
is
different. Common Core is just different. If we're going to, Common Core is a dramatic shift in the way we're teaching our kids math. It's a dramatic shift in focus away from classical literature. It's a dramatic shift away from, introducing a lot of reading into math, which isn't necessarily a good thing, especially in the younger grades where reading.
Okay, we've got a lot of time. We're going to get to everybody here coming up.